We have our eyes on every yacht and jet. We have our eyes on every piece of art and real estate purchased with dirty money. And
you're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez.
NATO leaders are convening right now in Brussels as the U.S. just announced
today to suspend normal trade relations with Russia as well as ban Russian.
We've been hearing a lot about sanctions. With a military option off the table, it's the main tool the United States and its allies are using to try to punish Russia for the brutal war in Ukraine. And one main target of sanctions is a class of mega-rich men with direct ties to Putin. These are the oligarchs.
Well, the White House announcing blocking sanctions on 8 wealthy Russians and their families. The most prominent person on the new list is Alisher Usmanov. He's got a net worth of around $20 billion. He's got stakes in steel, media, and internet companies.
And he owns the Dilbar.
Dilbar is the largest motor yacht in the world by gross tonnage. Dilbar has nearly 41,000 square feet of living space and 2 helipads.
Stretching almost the length of 2 football fields, the Dilbar is now stuck in a German shipyard in Hamburg, one of many opulent casualties of an economic war aimed at squeezing Putin through members of his inner circle, like Alisher Usmanov.
So Alisher Usmanov is a longtime Russian billionaire. He started actually before the fall of the Soviet Union. He had his first business, which was reasonably successful. He then became an executive in the oil and gas industry in Russia, and then eventually got into owning a series of companies that deal in telecommunications, technology, but mostly mining and metals. And he's made a fortune in these industries. Some of it is his own acumen. He's always been known as a smart businessman, but some of it is also good relations with both the Yeltsin and the Putin regimes in Russia. And he's gotten a lot of very good deals from the state.
That's Drew Sullivan. He founded the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project based in Sarajevo, Bosnia. It's one of the most effective groups tracking the opaque flows of Russian oligarch money. This week on World Affairs, we follow the money to understand the connection between Vladimir Putin, the oligarchs, and how sanctions may or may not be effective. We start with Drew Sullivan explaining why it's so hard to find assets like those belonging to Alisher Usmanov.
He's moved a lot of his assets abroad. He owns the Everton Football Club. He owns a lot of airplanes and yachts, Dilbar and others, and has basically lived one of the classic oligarch lifestyles in the West with large houses and a lot of money. And he's hidden it by using offshore companies for the most part. Most of his assets are either in Russia or they're in offshore companies that are registered in places that are not transparent. And we were able to find out some of the money he had when we looked at a leak that we got from Credit Suisse Bank, which showed that his sister in Tashkent, who's a gynecologist, had about $2 to $3 billion in her Credit Suisse accounts, which we assume probably came originally from him.
Yeah, assuming it's not just a great practice in Tashkent, the capital of Uzbekistan. What's in a guy like Usmanov's playbook? If you are a man, and they're mostly men, who have access to ownership of this vast pool of capital, what are the techniques you use to hide your money?
So there are a lot of different techniques you can use. I mean, most of them are predicated on this concept of the offshore. If you've got an offshore company, then that company, and it's usually not just one company, it's a nested set of companies. So it might be a Seychelles company owning a Panamanian company, which owns a Belizean company. And so consequently, it's impossible for anybody to ever trace the ownership through these multiple companies. And then on top of that, it may not be, again, in your name. It might be in the name of somebody who's in your business. It might be in the name of a family member. It might be in the name of your lawyer in Cyprus. Some companies themselves offer, you know, nominee shareholders or nominee directors of the company. So it's actually the registration agent whose name appears on the asset. Or it could just be some babushka who is, you know, out in the middle of Uzbekistan and everything is in her name and nobody really knows who's behind her. So there's a lot of different ways that this works. But usually it starts with an offshore company, although people like Usmanov, they're a little bit more sophisticated. They'll often use trusts. He simply says, I don't own the properties anymore. They're all in this family trust, and I no longer have control over that family trust.
It's funny to think of these men, and there are lots of them, hiding their money, when it seems like a lot of them live out loud, nothing hidden about it. They buy English Premier League soccer clubs, super yachts, apartments in some of the most expensive residential districts in the world. Is this like an iceberg where we might see what looks like a pretty big peak sticking out of the water, but it's really massive below the surface where you can't see it?
That's the unique thing about the Russian oligarchs. There's a weird thing where all of them have to have a plane and a ostentatious yacht and a mansion somewhere. And it's almost something that they have to do to kind of keep their standing in Russian business circles or amongst the other oligarchs. They're all fairly ostentatious about some of the assets that they have. But underneath it all, they don't really want anybody to know how much they really own. Because, you know, Russia is a pretty difficult place. Business is a death sport, and you can end up on the wrong end of things. And so consequently, they're careful about really showing where their true assets are. And Usmanov has been very clever in that he, back in 2014, started getting rid of part of his assets, but he kept 49%. And 49% is, of course, just below the threshold for being sanctioned by the United States and having your properties taken away. So the United States does not sanction assets that are less than 49%. So 51% is owned by some offshore and 49% is owned in his name.
You're the co-founder for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. You know, the title seems pretty self-explanatory, but you saw a gap in the marketplace. Why did you found this organization, and what do you set about doing?
So back in about 2006, 2007, I was a reporter, and I was working and training in Bosnia, and I realized that when it came down to any big issue, it became an issue of corruption and organized crime. In Eastern Europe and in Russia, in these places, everything is political. And so to get ahead, you need to be political and you need to be corrupt. And so we were seeing that businesses and jobs and presidential election slots and everything was really dependent on the corruption that was going on. And so it's just such a fascinating story, and these people are fascinating people. I mean, these are businessmen. You think of like if Bill Gates and Elon Musk killed, you know, that's the kind of people that you're talking about when you're talking about a good Russian oligarch. Many of these people survived wars that cost the lives of hundreds of people in their industry, and they came out on top.
Part of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project is something called the Russian Asset Tracker. So if one of our listeners goes to the Russian asset tracker and goes to look at the Usmanov holdings, what can you find there?
The website lists a number of his assets, including some of his large houses that he has in the UK, some of his mansions, but also we list 27 bank accounts that he has at Credit Suisse, worth about $2 billion. It lists his airplane. He's got an Airbus A340. It's got some of his yachts. It's got some of his Sardinian coastal real estate, some buildings in Croatia. So it basically gives you some sense as to all the assets he has around the world, some of them in his family, some of them in his own personal name. And you get a sense as to what he's been spending his money on. And this is going to be really 2 to 3 year process of trying to uncover many of the assets of these people and make them available to law enforcement and governments so that they can see if they should be seized and maybe someday hopefully be returned to the rightful owners, which are the people of Russia who've lost out a lot. You know, Russia's not a very nice country outside of Moscow. There's a lot of poverty and difficult times. So,
well, once someone gets the information that you've managed to amass, what can they do with it? I mean, once you have the knowledge, who is it useful for? Governments, taxing authorities? Who wants to know what the asset tracker is finding out?
Well, first of all, the governments that are sanctioning these individuals will want to know if there's things like real property in their country and if this particular person is an enabler of someone like Putin. I mean, if, you know, we've always said that many of Russia's oligarchs are agents of Putin. They do his dirty work. They move his money around the world. You know, Putin, he's not just a political leader of a country, and he doesn't just run the military. He runs organized crime. He runs almost every business, I mean, through these types of people. So this is his control over his country, and it's also control over other countries because many of these people have moved to other countries and then still continue to work on behalf of Russia. So, but it's also for business people. I mean, you want to know who you're doing business with and you want to know who's investing in your country because if you don't, then you get the situation where in many cases, you know, you may have a democracy, but you may have people working to undermine your democracy by funding extremist parties or political opposition groups, or, you know, hate groups. And opaque money is opaque power. And we need to know who's behind the money.
You mentioned Belize and Panama earlier on in our conversation. Is the long and short of it that governments are often partners in the kind of opacity that accompanies these men hiding their fortunes?
That's really true, Ray. I mean, that they are the enablers. If you look around the world, none of this would have been possible if what we call the criminal services industry, that's the law firms, the hedge funds, the registration agents, bankers who have made this possible. The globalization of organized crime and corruption happened about 20 years ago. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and they recruit this kind of money. They want this kind of money to come and to help these people set up their tax mitigation or tax evasion systems, however you want to view it, and to help these people move their money around the world. And if you look, you know, many people are part of that system. Donald Trump, you know, made apartments for wealthy individuals who were often made their money offshore. So he got rich off the criminal services industry. You know, this is a huge business, and it's becoming politically powerful and influential as well. And it serves to protect these kind of laws that allow this money to move around and to avoid figuring out who's really behind it.
Drew Sullivan is the co-founder and editor of OCCRP, the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, which operates the Russian Asset Tracker. He's joining us from Sarajevo. Let me welcome to the program now Karen Greenaway. She's an attorney, a retired FBI supervisory special agent, and now a consultant on anti-corruption and anti-money laundering operations. Karen Greenaway, welcome to World Affairs.
Thank you, Ray. I'm glad to be here.
Now, the yacht thought to belong to Alisher Usmanov that we were talking about, is there an already existing legal mechanism to seize that yacht without benefit of what we might consider due process, hearings, trials? Can you seize now and litigate later?
So the short answer is no, there is not a process that allows us to seize now and litigate later in order to deprive people like Mr. Usmanov of his property rights in something like the yacht or a home or something like that. What has been done now is that some countries have sanctioned Mr. Usmanov, and sanction allows us to seize the property until the individual or entity or country changes behavior that they were sanctioned for. So at some point, assuming Mr. Usmanov changes his behavior that he was sanctioned for, he will get his yacht back. And oh, by the way, the country that seized it is going to have to maintain it and keep it up and return it in the same condition that they seized it in.
Well, the absence of that legal machinery that you mentioned, in a situation like the one we're talking about now with Russia's oligarchs and the invasion of Ukraine, doesn't it, in effect, just put them all on notice so they can begin reforming their fortunes, selling assets, moving capital, and burrowing in even deeper in a less detectable way?
So, yes, in some respects, it does allow the oligarchs who have not been sanctioned yet to burrow in, as you just described it, by moving their assets around. But if they have already been sanctioned and they engage in that process of burrowing in, of moving their assets around, of selling to, you know, at least on paper, a percentage of their ownership interest in properties that are associated with them, then that would be sanctions evasion. And we actually, in the United States and in other countries, we can actually prosecute people for evading sanctions.
Is there a difference between sovereign wealth, like the Russian government's currency reserves that have been frozen in various places around the world, and the money of a Putin associate who is a private citizen with privately held assets? Do they exist in two different legal realms, if you will?
So I would say, yes, that's a good description. As it relates to sovereign wealth, you know, the Russian government wealth, in terms of how we would repurpose that wealth, for example, to pay war reparations in Ukraine, that is going to have to be a legal process that has gone through by the government of Russia in courts like the International Court of Justice. And there will have to be an agreement in part of this part of the state or the government of Russia to pay reparations. As it relates to these private individuals, there are legal processes, but they would have to be addressed at the individual and the assets associated with them within a particular country where they have an asset, not at this state-to-state level, which is where the Russian sovereign wealth resides.
Balzac famously said, "Behind every fortune lies a great crime." I won't attempt to say it in French. But once a dollar, a euro, a pound sterling has been moved through shell companies, properties bought and sold to cronies and mistresses and children, is the original crime still actionable? If a great fortune begins with Kremlin chicanery in a 1990s Moscow free-for-all, can you still go after it now that it's a sports team in London or a exclusive apartment in New York or a shipping company in Sao Paulo, Brazil?
So what you're talking about, of course, is money laundering. Could we bring or do an investigation on this money that was gotten in the 1990s through criminal chicanery or, you know, organized crime or racketeering activity and trace it into an asset that has been purchased, you know, with, let's say, even within the last 10 years? And the answer is, generally, no. Most countries' money laundering statutes have what's called a statute of limitations for that crime, and that crime is usually no more than 10 years old.
So given what you know about the way these things work, are we now, is the world now, embarking on a process that's going to take a really long time?
The simple answer is yes. But I do believe that one of the things that really should be considered here is what is change of behavior for the oligarchs. And what I mean by that is we've established that change of behavior for sanctions, for example, some of the government officials or the country of Russia itself, is that, you know, it stopped the war in Ukraine. The fact of the matter is if we just say, okay, well, the war in Ukraine has ended, you know, let's all go back to business, these oligarchs are just going to go back and do the same thing. So what I and I, others are suggesting is that there be some sort of negotiation process with the oligarchs that requires them to disgorge part of their assets if they want to continue operating in our markets, and also establish mechanisms so that we can see transparently that they are behaving like other business people and other corporations are required to in all of our countries.
There's been a lot of speculation, a lot of attention to cryptocurrency. Is it a promising place to hide your boodle? If you're an oligarch looking nervously at the headlines in the business pages, are you looking into Bitcoin right now?
The thing about cryptocurrency, of course, though, is it still has to be attached to a financial system. And what I mean by that is if you're going to turn dollars into Bitcoin, you still have to do a financial transaction in order to do that. And then, of course, you can trace it once you know who owns it, you know, online, because it's all publicly available. So if you want to move, you know, $1 billion into Bitcoin tomorrow, that's going to be, you know, something that will attract the attention of especially people who trade in Bitcoin, because they're going to start wondering who it is that's starting to move massive amount of money into Bitcoin, and would that Bitcoin be available to buy? So there are a number of positives for an oligarch about investing in cryptocurrency, but there are also a number of challenges, especially if it relates to putting massive amounts of money into cryptocurrency.
Karen Greenaway is with me. Let me bring Drew Sullivan back into the conversation. Western nations, being good places to invest and with proper legal systems and protection for property, have been the end destination for untold billions of dollars of these assets. Are Western governments reluctant to go down this road in part because of the possibility of massive retaliation from a place with only a nodding acquaintance with the rule of law like contemporary Russia?
Yeah, it's a difficult political question. I mean, you know, there's a lot of Western assets in Russia that potentially could be nationalized by Russia. So if we somehow seize these assets in the West, then there could be a corresponding seizure in Russia. My sense is that right now this is being seen as a way to directly affect the ability of Putin to control his country. And I think that probably this is seen as a short-term solution, and there isn't a strong desire long-term to take these assets permanently. But you never know. I mean, I think it's going to depend on how the war goes, and it depends on what Putin does. It's, you know, we've used a lot of our tools that we have available to us to pressure Putin. So I think if the situation gets worse with the war, that there might be a more aggressive approach to some of these assets.
President Biden, he's had no hesitation about calling these assets ill-gotten. And Russia continues, even as we speak, to destroy Ukrainian capital, apartment buildings, factories, public buildings, monuments. Is there any precedent for using the privately held assets of a country's nationals to pay compensation to a country that's been invaded or victimized or had its property destroyed? Could the proceeds from seized yachts end up rebuilding housing in Kharkiv or Mariupol? Is there any way that this happens? Or is this really just a way of showing the distaste in the West for these oligarchs? From what I've heard you both say so far, it's not looking very promising that that the Dilbar is going to end up creating wealth that can rebuild a school in a major Ukrainian city.
It's not very promising, unfortunately. But that's where I think the number of NGOs and the number of civil activists who are out there who have been trying to bring about change in all of our countries to take on this mechanism of enablers and allowing dirty money to come into our country from Russia are really stepping up and trying to bring pressure on our own governments to say no more business as usual it relates to Russia, no matter how this ends in Ukraine.
Drew?
I really suspect that Ukraine is going to have something to say about this. They can certainly take Russia to court in any number of jurisdictions and seek to recover damages from the war. And so they may make the argument that these oligarchs have benefited from the Russian state and were helping the Russian state, and that their assets should be seized and used to pay debt. I don't know whether that argument will work in court, but it certainly can be made. And I think, you know, in the long run, it's really going to depend on where this war goes next. I think there's other tools that some of these countries can pull out to be more aggressive with some of these oligarchs. And make no mistake, I mean, you know, the oligarchs are part of Putin's foreign policy. So, and there's plenty of examples of where they've played a really significant role. And so consequently, the argument may be made and it may, you know, have some traction in some jurisdictions.
Do you expect that stuff is going to get pulled out of banks, property, both real and securities, and just end up heading east to Tashkent, the capital of Uzbekistan, and on and on? Is it just going to go end up in venues where there are going to be fewer questions asked, even less demand for transparency? Is this going to begin a process of forcing these guys to just put their fortunes elsewhere?
It's already happening. I mean, since 2014, there probably has been a net gain in places like Dubai, which is essentially a place that's fairly protected from most international seizures. We've seen that already happening. And in fact, you know, Azerbaijan is trying to build their own version of Dubai in the White City, and other places are interested in doing that as well. So a lot of Russian money has flowed into those types of jurisdictions already, and I would expect more is already going. In fact, a lot of the airplanes and yachts are already in Dubai. You know, this is a problem because we're going to be in a situation where the more of these kind of financial black holes we have around the world, and the more they serve this kind of money, the more difficult it is to stop crime and corruption.
Drew Sullivan is co-founder and editor of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. He joined us from Sarajevo. Thanks a lot, Drew.
Thank you.
And Karen Greenaway is an attorney and an FBI retired supervisory special agent. She consults with groups like Drew's on anti-corruption, anti-money laundering, and sanctions. She joined us from Virginia. A pleasure to have you, Karen.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you.